And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHL with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. You remember Prince Hal, Falstaff, Henry IV, Henry V, Parts 1, Part 2, a lot of Shakespeare. All of that's being brought together for us by the Playmakers. And I just have to say, under the leadership of producing artistic director Joe Hodge, who has stepped aside from all those duties sort of to direct this combination of plays. Joe, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here, DJ.
You brought with you two of your colleagues, Jeff Mianza, who's the associate artistic Artistic director, and Mike Donahue, who's your co-director.
Yes.
Tell us, all right, now look, just recently you're on the front page of the Daily Tar Heel, all up in competition on the same day that you would have expected the announcement that the incumbent governor is not going to run for re-election. You steal the top of the front page from her. How can you rationalize a play being as important, more important, than a governor deciding she's going to step down?
Well, that was hardly my choice or my responsibility. I'm not sure which is more important than what, but I think Shakespeare's legacy will outlast even Governor Perdue's. I don't know. We're having a real good time making these real big plays, and we're flattered that the Tar Heel chose to lead with us this week.
Now, that's really incredible, but and an unfair question, and not the question that our listeners would want us to ask. So let me ask you another one, and that is, what is the background of bringing Shakespeare's set of plays to the Chapel Hill stage as one enterprise? And how did it get started? And
We have a resident acting company at Playmakers, and of course there aren't many theaters in the country that do. We're able to do big scale work, and with our success with Nicholas Nickleby a couple of years ago, Angels in America last year, these big epic stories, we're well positioned for it. Organizationally, we've learned something about how to do these big projects. You know, each of these plays, Henry IV Part 1 is a masterpiece. Henry IV Part 2 is a good play. Henry V is also a masterpiece. These are spectacular plays standing alone. Putting them in conversation with each other allows us to track Hal's incredible journey from being, you know, in the taverns with Falstaff, drinking and whoring with the guys, and his incredible maturation process as he moves through the Henry IVs and then becomes one of, to this day, one of Britain's greatest monarchs. And these three plays taken in one big sweep allows us to chart the entire journey in a way that I think is sort of incredible and profound.
For those of us who've graduated from college a number of years ago and may have been that long since we studied Shakespeare, in a college Shakespeare course, you're going to get these plays, or at least one or two of them.
That's true.
But I've forgotten why. Tell us what's the underlying story that helped Shakespeare make the dramatization of the story is so powerful.
I wonder, Mike, if you'd like to talk about
this. Is Mike Donahue, the co-director of this production.
Yes. Hi. Well, it's a true story that it's based on. I mean, Henry IV was king of England. He and some other people sort of usurped the throne from Richard II and then killed him. And then Henry IV's son is Hal, who we start the journey with, who is left behind the world of his father's court, is living in the tavern with Falstaff and these other guys, as Joe was saying. And over the course of the Henry IVs, has to join his father in fighting off rebels and in helping to calm a civil war in England, which was all sort of historically true. And by the end of Henry IV, his father passes away and the crown goes to Hal.
Is the civil war just personalities among the
You know what happens? Henry IV and some of his really good friends got together and usurped the throne from Richard and killed Richard. And after that happened, they all started fighting. The idea being that, you know, once you sort of upset the natural order of things, and once the order of succession is broken and there's a power void and people start scrambling to fill that void, people necessarily start fighting with one another. And it's hard to trust even your friends after you've all broken the trust.
Sort of like in Egypt, where the combination of people have overthrown the regime, and now that that's done, they're fighting among themselves.
Yeah, you know, there's this wonderful line, Richard, it's not in our plays, well, I guess it's referenced in our plays, the line of Richard's from Richard II, where Richard, when he's when the throne is being taken from him, warns, you know, when that guy becomes king, he says, though he divide the realm and give thee half, you will think it not enough, having helped him to all. And you watch that happen in the course of these plays.
Well, I interrupted you, Jeff. Joe, I guess. But we didn't let you tell the story, Mike.
No, but that civil war is something that was actually happening. And everyone sort of suffers from that increasing paranoia and guilt about that.
So this is in the first two plays?
Both of the Henry IVs. A civil war that's partially stopped by the end of the first one, when Hal kills his great rival Hotspur. And then it continues through the Henry IV part two. And in Henry IV part two, they're able to stop the civil war. But unfortunately, it's a little bit too late, and it's right around the time that Henry IV himself passes away. The sort of like extreme guilt and self-hatred that guy felt because of what he had done. Pretty miserable, guilt-ridden life after that. And that guilt sort of manifested itself in this kind of psychosomatic way that was eating away at him. And he stopped sleeping. He was having sort of like fainting spells. And he passes away at the end of the play, and Hal assumes the crown and becomes king.
Well, did he do anything as king? I mean, other than get to be king?
Well, you know, part of what the Civil War was about, it was the beginning of having an organized center of government. So the plays, part of the Civil War, the whole reason for it is you have these feudal leaders, feudal warlords, if you will, who are used to having autonomy and power. And when Bolingbroke's on the throne with some of these feudal lords who have made him king, and he asserts his will for there to be sort of an organized center of government with himself at the head, much of the Civil War is watching Northumberland and Mortimer and Glendower, these the rebels, pushing hard against this guy who all of a sudden thinks he can tell them what to do.
Well, now I'm looking for current analogies, like in Afghanistan, where we think, we got this. Karzai is in charge of, and they have a national government, and yet there are these warlords or influential people across the country have their own little dominions, and they're not interested in saluting and giving up power.
Indeed, and we don't even have to look that far afield. I mean, you can look at states' rights folks in this country versus an idea of big government versus small government. You know, we're in these conversations still today in our own country, I think.
Well, we might keep on. We got through parts.
To be clear, those two parts of Henry IV are combined into one evening. So what Mike just described was the arc of one of our evenings of plays, which will run in rep with Henry V. And that story is.
Well, let me just ask you about this, because this is a question. You know, I love this, but long evenings. You know, I'm getting old, so you've got two plays into one.
Yeah.
How do you bring it into one evening?
You cut.
You cut Shakespeare.
Yeah. Well, my goodness, everybody should. We've combined the two plays into one evening of theater that's maybe 3 hours and 20 minutes long with two intermissions. So it's a big evening of theater. When one cuts these plays, when one works on adapting these plays, directors typically do this work, so often with a dramaturg, but directors do this work based on what are the themes most salient to that director? What do we want to explore? And Mike and I chose in this big journey that we really wanted to concentrate. We've called the big big arc of it, The Making of a King. And we really adapted the scripts, cut the scripts around an idea of tracking Hal's trajectory, which we think is a pretty great ride. And so that's how we, those are the choice. Everything's good. You're not choosing based on what is good material versus what is not good material. It's all good. It's really making choices about which themes you most want to follow.
Well, Joe Hodge, did, as you confess or assert and take responsibility for editing Shakespeare, one of the things that makes it different is this becomes yours. This is not something that you ordered from New York, how they did it in New York, although you must be influenced by what some other people have done. This is y'all's. This is what y'all did.
Yeah.
And why don't you just go get what some successful person did some other place and do that play?
Well, you know, you couldn't do that if you wanted to. You know, you're in a room with a bunch of other artists. You have other designers, there are other directors, there are other actors in the room, all of whom are bringing.
So this is a collaborative effort, not just your
effort. Of course. We have 24 actors playing 85.
And so
roles.
As you're talking, are you sitting around a table with your actors and you're saying, which part would you like to do?
No. No, we cast it, of course, and Mike and I made those decisions very specifically. But then when we're in the rehearsal room and we say, so who is Falstaff? What is he after? What's this guy? An actor. And we have a great actor playing Falstaff in Mike Winters. So, you know, this actor is going to have opinions about who this guy is that need to fold into our own ideas about what we want the production to explore.
Is the rule you can cut Shakespeare, but you can't change? You can't change the language?
There are no rules. It's 400 years old. It's in the public domain.
Right.
People can do anything they want to.
But what were the rules that got it?
Right. So the rules we use are very much as you described. We haven't rewritten anything. They're all Shakespeare's lines. There are things that have been edited out. There have been a few things that have been moved around, some things earlier or later. But we're certainly not adding text. We're not rewriting Shakespeare or writing scenes into the play. Although people can and sometimes do.
You've got great things to work with. How long are you going to keep us there? 3 1/4 hours?
Three and a half hours? Yes.
3 1/2 hours.
For Henry IV.
And so this is a challenge to keep, you know, to keep the audience. And you, here are the assets that I think you might have. And I want you to tell me what the other assets are. But you got Falstaff, who is an enduring kind of character that even if we don't know the plays, if you say Falstaff, you know everybody, I mean many people know whom you're talking about, and you're anxious to see this sort of comic figure who's more than a comic figure, but he's going to entertain us. Mm-hmm. So you got him there. And then you got Hotspur, who's kind of, I mean, we sort of know what that might. Yeah. And then Hal, this drinking, happy-go-lucky, but non-responsible person who's going to get reformed. Mm-hmm. Have that sort of in mind, so there'll be some entertainment. But what are you going to do? I mean, that's a long time to keep people interested.
Yeah,
you got a lot of gun shooting. No, you don't even have guns. You don't have any gunpowder back there.
3 hours and 20 minutes.
Yeah. You know, the story's fantastic. And I think we've been told for years that people don't have the attention span, and what everybody wants is, you know, the two-person play that's 75 minutes and is really happy and people can go home because nobody has the attention span for the longer thing. But in fact, we see in popular culture, we just see that that's absolutely not true. I mean, you watch these kids, children, carrying around these huge Harry Potter books, reading thousands and thousands of pages, getting deeply involved in this complicated narrative which goes on for days. And so again, I mean, not to reduce Shakespeare to pop culture, but I think there's something in the zeitgeist of these big scale, large epic work where we can actually sit down with characters for a long period of time. The films, the way some people sit down and watch seasons of The Wire or now download whole seasons of shows on Netflix, and we'll sit and watch them all on a weekend, getting immersed in the lives and the stories. And I think that's what we've been doing with Nicholas Nickleby. It's what we did with Angels in America, and I think it's what we're doing here with Henry plays.
Well, we're visiting with Joe Hodge, with Mike Donahue, who's his co-director on the Making of a King, Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, and Henry V. And we're going to be visiting with Jeff Meanza. We'll be talking about how this fits in with our community. And all of us will be exploring Henry IV and Henry V again after this short break.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you joined us late, the Playmakers are bringing to the stage here in Chapel Hill three of Shakespeare's greatest plays, and they're compacting it into two segments, but it's all about the England during the times of Henry IV and Henry V. It brings up all sorts of opportunity for engagement outside the community. And Jeff Mianza, you're sort of overseeing some of this. What did you think about doing, and then what did you decide to do?
Well,
what are the opportunities, and which are you exploiting?
Well, when Joe and I were first talking about his interest in producing these plays, he had read a book by Chris Hedges, which is called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which is largely about America's, what he posits is America's cultural addiction to war. And looking at the last 20 years of American history and current military engagement, and this sort of got us thinking about, well, then is that the access point for a really meaningful series of community events that would take these plays out into the world and really drive home what this exploration sets out to do, which is to take a look at the cost of war, not just for those who choose to participate in it, but the country at large, the families of those soldiers who go off to war. And so then we started developing this idea of something that we haven't done before, how can we potentially reach out to the military community in the state of North Carolina? So that's where it all launched off from.
That's the launch pad.
Yeah.
And then, so what's developed?
So we contacted Chris Hedges and said, we're doing these plays. We read your book. We think it's fascinating. Would you like to come down and talk to our patrons and our community about your thinking around not just this book.
The addiction to war idea of viewing America from that perspective.
Yeah. So on February 13th, he'll be here at the theater for a conversation about his work and I think influenced by the play.
What's he going to say?
You know, he's a war correspondent. Yeah. He's spent time, very close.
This is Joe Hodge talking now.
Yeah. I mean, Chris Hedges is a guy who's been very close to embedded in these theater of operations. He knows deeply what our men are there to do and what we're asking them to do, our men and women, of course. And this guy has, he's a fantastic thinker, big thinker about these ideas of as Jeff describes, the cultural addiction to war.
What does that mean? I mean, what are you talking about? I mean, as best you can describe it, what do you think summarize his sort of perspective or message? Culturally addicted to war.
Yeah, well, that if there is such a thing as a warring culture, that there is, if you look at the series of engagements that we've had, Iraq, Afghanistan, the first Iraq war, that over the course of the last 20 years in Vietnam before that, or Grenada, I mean, like all of these different, that we are a country that has over the last 30 years resorted to military action in a series of ongoing events. And I don't think we're taking the statement that we as a theater are taking a viewpoint that is either positive or negative mm-hmm. against that. But saying, just lifting it up and saying, let's talk about it.
Can I just jump in
here?
You know, Shakespeare in these plays, one of the last things Henry IV says on his deathbed in giving advice to his son, all through Henry IV, as we described, they've been involved in civil war. The dying words of Henry IV to his son is to busy giddy minds with foreign quarrels.
Oh, yeah.
He urges Hal to take his country to a foreign war as a way to galvanize his country. I don't know. I think there's tremendous resonance in our current moment and in what Shakespeare was writing about over 400 years ago.
So, I mean, taking that advice from Henry IV to his son, if you want to get out of civil wars and civil disputes and then think about getting all of us together in a foreign war.
Yeah.
And is that what Is that what he's talking about? That to minimize our all this division that we have at home, get behind the soldiers in Iraq or get behind the soldiers in Afghanistan or wherever they are. We got to stay behind them. That unifies us, and we can get some things done at home.
I think that's part of it. I think that's part
and
of it.
What's the other part?
Well. If you come on February 13th, you can hear him tell you. I don't want to speak.
We can't speak for Chris
for him.
No,
yes.
but it's fair for me to press you about why you wanted him to come and what kind of ideas you thought he put
absolutely.
Forth in his
you know,
book.
These plays are not making. Shakespeare knows how to write an anti-war play. He wrote it. I mean, Troilus and Cressida is expressly an anti-war play. He doesn't seem to be dealing with that in these plays. He doesn't seem to be making any great pronouncement about whether war is a good thing or whether war is a bad thing. But there's a profound exploration in these plays of the cost of war should one choose to wage it, the tremendous price of war, as Jeff described, for those involved, for those who stay home. And in Hal's trajectory, the terrible cost of leadership, the things that must necessarily be given up to be a leader. He has to forego his former life. He has to forego the fellowship of all those folks at the tavern. He has to banish Falstaff. He has to execute his friends. He has to, in order to become the leader that he is, and he's one of the great military leaders in history, if one is to study the thing, and he could just as easily have been hanged for war crimes. And we're trying to make a production that can show that isn't making a choice about is he a hero or is he a war criminal? Because the play doesn't seem to make that decision either way. But to show dimensionally a person who is capable of great and profound and extraordinary leadership who also does some pretty heinous things along the way.
Well, Jeff, I nailed you down on just one of the things that you're doing community-wide. I mean, you don't have to tell us about everything, but talk about some of the things that today you're most excited about.
Yeah, well, one of the most exciting things is that we are going to go to Fayetteville, and we're going to take some scenes from the shows have a community dialogue. We're partnering with an organization called the Army's Army, which is a volunteer organization that provides service to service members and their families, and we're partnering with Cape Fear Regional Theater in Fayetteville to host us for these scenes and the conversation. So that's super exciting. And then we're also screening a film. There's the Ackland Art Museum has a series called the Ackland Film Forum, and a recently Oscar-nominated film, Helen Back Again, which is a devastating portrait of a soldier who comes back from Afghanistan wounded, and what his life is like now as a soldier in recovery because of his wounds, and the psychology of someone who comes back after heavy military engagement and how that impacts him. And I think more importantly, the people around him, especially his wife. It's a devastating film in terms of just things that we don't get to see unless you have a family member who is a part of that. Yeah.
And there's a scene in Henry IV between Hotspur and his wife, Lady Percy, where Lady Percy says, you know, I don't know where you are. I don't know what you're doing. You're talking in your sleep. There are beads of sweat. She's describing him as he's preparing for war and as he's been moving forward with the rebel plans. And having been in war continuously, and I was talking to a psychoanalyst about that scene. He said, you know, psychoanalysts use this scene. It describes PTSD 400 years before it was a term. You know, again, there's just much in this play that really resonates in our current moment. And I think some of what we're looking to do by partnering with these groups, taking this work out to Fayetteville, hopefully having military families involved is there's still much to learn from what Shakespeare has to say, you know, in the way that Shakespeare's always out ahead of us. You know, you kind of can't go anywhere without finding that Shakespeare's been there first, you know.
Well, we're visiting with Joe Hodge and his co-director Mike Donahue, and also with Jeff Mienza, the associate artistic director. We're talking about The Making of a King, Henry IV and Henry V, brought to us in, is it repertory? How do you?
Yes, in rotating rep.
Rotating rep.
Yeah.
The four of us will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin with Vistin about all kinds of things related to the playmakers' current productions of The Making of a King, Henry IV, and Henry V. These are two sections of three plays that will be presented to us in two segments over two nights, or in some cases maybe all in one day that you can take it for those who really want to see the whole thing at once. Jeff, Joe pointed out during the break that you got some recognition and some grants for doing this, some help outside and recognition.
Yeah.
Tell us about that briefly.
Yeah, sure. So the NEA has awarded us, we're one of three theaters in the country to receive a very significant support. The largest grant that they offered for theaters last year, it was the Goodman Theater in Chicago, Lincoln Center Theater in New York, and Playmakers received $100,000 in support of the production and then the outreach around it, which will help us get to Fayetteville and elsewhere. And we also received a grant, part of Shakespeare for a New Generation, which gives us $25,000 to take teaching artists into the classroom and bring students in to see production, the production of Henry V in particular.
So that's really interesting that some of the outreach efforts and the kinds of opportunities that be available for us through the Chapel Hill community are made possible because you all have gotten the recognition that you deserve from a national organization.
Yeah.
You've got some money to supplement your effort.
Yeah.
I want to, you know, y'all have been, and if you join us late, we were talking about some of the current, contemporary messages from Shakespeare about war and a lot of negative, a lot of the realistic negative consequences of war, even the best of wars, I guess, we talked about. But it keeps coming back to me, Mike Donahue, co-directing this. We've talked about Henry IV, parts one and two, and then you get to Henry V, and the Falstaff's all gone, but you've got this war in France, and you've got this great speech that Henry V makes. It makes you cry. Can't call that a negative. I mean, do you remember that speech? And nobody can quote it, but I mean, you can quote lines of it.
Crispin's Day. I bet Joe could quote some of it for us.
Probably. but come see the play. One should buy a ticket.
No, but tell us.
Good actors.
But I mean, what is the Henry's talking to his soldiers about? I've got him in mind of saying we're going to be sitting around the VFW hall 25. I'll start crying when I do this.
Yeah.
25 years from now. And we'll have been there during this terrible times, and we're bound together, and everybody else won't have been there.
Yeah.
People will remember us. They'll talk about us for generations to come, that we were there in that moment, that we are brothers in this moment, and we fight as a family.
We happy few, we band of brothers.
Yeah.
And you know, it is such a powerful narrative, and it is so seductive. And military leaders have been using that speech pretty much from the minute it was written.
Oh, really?
To motivate their troops. And I mean, I don't think it's an accident. You know, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers, we few, we proud the Marines. I mean, like, that script is, it's the roadmap for how we talk to young men and women about the military.
It's incredibly seductive.
It's incredibly seductive. And this idea of the exceptionalism, you're special, you're doing something that's filled with meaning. In this documentary that we're screening that Jeff is talking about, I mean, this guy who gets injured and comes home, you know, he's losing his mind trying to find a parking spot at Walmart. I mean, he comes from being a captain in Afghanistan, leading his men, doing something where he is deriving real meaning from the work that he's doing. And then he's reduced to picking up paper towels at Walmart, and he can't make sense of his life. It's a fantastic documentary. I hope people will join us for that screening.
And in fact, in that documentary, there's a scene where one of the army officials who's higher up gives a speech that is a version of that Crispin's Day speech.
Absolutely.
He says that very thing.
Well, I mean, this is interesting because as someone who's, you know, further along in years than you guys are, the search for meaning down the road is also contained. How are we and my colleagues special compared to every others, and we do find meaning in this, or could in either military service or in politics or on the football team, or these things that we did that other people didn't understand, didn't respect maybe, and are dangerous in some respect, or we're doing things that might not be totally productive. So it goes beyond war, but war is important. When you're out there on the, when you've been sent out on the battlefield and you're trying to figure out, what in the heck am I doing here in this mud and this danger and something, my leg's going to get blown off, and what is it, what is there for me? That this, these ideas, you know, I guess it they resonate for different reasons for different people.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, it's beautifully said. I think that's right. And you know, you know, of course, Henry V, that Crispin's Day is on he delivers that speech right before the Battle of Agincourt, which is
Didn't we forget what happened? Yeah, what happens?
Well, you know.
Or do we have to, are you going to make us see the play, or will you tell
us?
Well,
you got to come see the play. It's one of the biggest military upsets, again, in military history, and recognized as such. And it's interesting, the history on it is superb. You can read an awful lot on it. A lot of people wrote about it just afterwards, and it's spectacular reading about how they manage this incredible military upset. And even for reading all this strategy, it's kind of a miracle. Like for all the strategy, for all the good thinking, for all the ways that the English managed to upset.
So they're in France. They're fighting indigenous. Always a problem.
And they pull off
a victory.
They're outnumbered 5-1. Henry's lost half his men to dysentery and attrition. The French are, they outnumber them 5-1, and the French are they're fresh. They have horses. They're they have numbers on their side. They're fighting on their home turf, and for all that, the British pull off one of the great military upsets ever. And the final chorus. So Henry V has a chorus who serves as a sort of narrator for us, and kind of connects moments through the play. And you know, after Henry wins France, the last chorus of the play, it's very short, and the chorus comes out and says, Henry V had a son in infant bands, crowned king, who so many had the managing that he lost France and made his English bleed. And there's something very, you know, for the seduction of the narrative and how powerful it is, the story of that upset and what England, it's like, it was all lost in half a generation. It was all gone. You know, whether wars are good or wars are bad, certainly one measurement of a war perhaps is it worth what it has cost? And Henry's winning France is, you know, whatever that is, 20 years later, 25 years later, it's gone. You know, it's not preserved. It's not.
And so the chorus is a warning, a look into the future from that particular point.
Yeah,
that
it's not the play is so fascinating because on the one hand it is of course a spectacular heroic narrative, and on the other Shakespeare seems to be questioning everything he's saying right along the way with that heroic, which makes the journey such a rich and complex and profound one. I think there have been, like, if you look at the Olivier film and even the Branagh film, there's so much cut away to just sort of concentrate on the heroic narrative, but Shakespeare writes some things that really sort of take the legs out of some of the, you know, the chorus says, and now they're going to France, and everybody's dying to go. And then the next scene, you see a bunch of grunts going, I don't know what we're doing here. Why? So the play is really rich and complicated in that way.
Well, I tell you what, let's take a break, and then I want to ask you guys how you stage or how you get around showing these thousands of people in conflict with each other on the battlefield and how you represent that. That's got to be a challenge. And we're talking about The Making of a King, Henry IV and V. This is the Playmaker's upcoming or current production, a wild one and one that you don't want to miss. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about something dramatic that's happening in Chapel Hill. It's more than just a play. It's an outrageously ambitious undertaking to bring three of Shakespeare's plays to us and to deliver them to us in a contemporary fashion so that we can capture the whole sort of narrative. Audacious, maybe, is the right word. One of the audacious, and here to tell us about it is, of course, our friend, the producing artistic director of the Playmakers, Joe Hodge, who's also directing this production, his co-director, Mike Donahue, and the associate artistic director, Jeff Mianza, who's talking about how this play relates to the community. But Mike, let me ask you this. How do you, you know, we talked about the horrors of war, the consequences of war, the great excitement of victory in war. But what we want to see on the stage is we want to see a lot of conflict of that. But you can't bring a war to the stage, can you?
Well, you know, one of the ways that Henry V starts is this guy who plays the chorus comes out and apologizes in advance.
Oh,
he
really?
Says, we're not going to be able to have the things that we need to have to be able to show you this. What we're talking about, the story we're telling, is too big for the theater and what we can do in it. So we're going to give you the best version of it we can give you, which won't always be that good. And it's your responsibility in the audience to imagine it and fill in the blanks. So that chorus actually charges us in the audience with the responsibility.
Makes us be a participant in the imagining of the war. But you don't
exactly.
leave it there, do you? You don't leave it there. You help us.
We don't, no. But we have some fun with it. As Joe was saying before, you know, the chorus is continually promising things and then the play undercuts it. He tells us that everybody in England is really excited to go to war and then we see a bunch of grunts who are questioning mm-hmm. it. Similarly, he says, now Agincourt is on. We're going to go fight the Battle of Agincourt. Excuse the little sort of like meager mock of the war that we're going to show you. And then we cut to...
What is the meager mock? I want to see. We're going to have
yeah.
some fights.
Well,
we're
no, it's the scene that follows next. It's the only scene in the play that takes place in Agincourt, which is between a French soldier and this guy Pistol, who's one of the people from the tavern world back from when Hal was a kid. And the scene is kind of a joke of a war. Instead of it being a battle between these two people, it's a scene between Pistol, a guy who's at the war trying to find ways to make money and stay safe, doing everything he can not to actually fight and to exploit people to make money off of the thing, and a French soldier who's unarmed, totally helpless. They can't speak the same language to one another. The soldier mistakes Pistol for this guy who's a sort of like a great military hero and ends up sort of buying back his life from Pistol. And so there's not even actually a fight in that scene between the two of them. It's just the struggle to actually communicate in broken French and broken English to get to the point where Pistol can say, give me all your money and I'll let you go free.
Yeah. That's great.
And that is actually
That's the war scene
that
and a reminder that behind every one of these glorious things that happens in war, it's a bunch of people just trying to get along day to day and survive yeah. and stay well or get well. And it's, yeah.
It is. I mean, really what it seems to us that the play is examining is it's not like the actual moment of fighting. It's everything that leads up to that and everything that happens after that. So it's people the night before the fight trying to get into the right headspace to be able to go out and do what they're doing. It's people trying to reconcile themselves to understanding why they're fighting, who they're fighting for.
Well, now you told us that the making of the King Henry IV is 3.5 hours long or so. And how about you? How much time have you got for? How much time have you putting yourself in Henry V? Mike Donahue, you're the associate director. How long do you have to keep it going, and how do you do it?
Well, Henry V itself is a considerably shorter play. It's a little over 2 hours. And, you know, it kind of runs on a rail. That play has a chorus that sort of drops us into all of the important parts, and then we don't have to see anything else in it. And once Hal is crowned king, and he goes to war in France, the thing just flies. And it's
quite
streamlined.
Is it so that the action flies and that you don't need any of these dramatic horns blowing and bells ringing and sword fights and things like that.
Yeah,
keep
he
us,
tells
keep
you. The sword fights are all in Henry IV, actually. The chorus tells you this is the next important thing that you need to see. So skip all that other stuff that's sort of like gratuitous fat. Get to the marrow of the thing. This is the next thing that you need to see. And then he drops you there and you see the important part and then you get lifted out. So it's a little bit, it's like getting to watch like the trailer for the thing as opposed to having to sit through like all of the backstory of it.
Wow.
It's like the highlights.
Yeah, the chorus is, as Mike describes, the chorus takes the place of any of the scenes that might be in a play that give us a lot of exposition. And so the chorus will come out and say, okay, so this just happened, then this and this and this, and now this is what you need to know next, and here we are in France. And he drops the needle on the next moment. So it's sort of like the story of Henry V, only the good parts, is how the thing is built.
Well, Joe, you know, you've been working with this a long time.
Yeah.
And a very ambitious project. Are you happy?
I don't know if that's the exact word. It's hard, and we're still in it. It's really, you know, making plays is a very, very hard thing. We have an incredible company of actors. I have an incredible colleague in Mike Donahue working on this together. And you know, it's 6.5 hours of, or whatever that is, of Shakespeare. And that's very, very, very hard to do. Well, incredible designers, incredible team on it. You know, at this point, we're just going into previews.
Well, it is too early to ask.
Yeah.
You'll be closer to it as we listen to your conversation again and again. But let me ask you this. We've just got a minute. At this stage, would you ever consider doing this again in your lifetime, or is this a once-in-a-lifetime deal for you?
Well, this is my second Henry IV, Part 1, and second Henry IV, Part 2, and fourth Henry V, right. And I'm directing Henry V again in April at the
Oregon
Shakespeare
Festival. But the only time you've ever brought them all together.
Yeah. I mean, I think probably, yes. And that's why we're all working as hard as we are. You know, you don't get an infinite number of chances at these sorts of things.
No.
And so we're working hard to try to get this one right.
Well, Mike Donahue, Jeff Mianza, and Joe Hodge, thanks for coming and giving us this inside look at what must be not only hard and tiring, but also an exhilarating experience that you all are having doing this audacious project. I see it, Making of a King, Henry IV and V, William Shakespeare, as edited by this team that you've heard today. And it's great, a great production. I can't wait.
Thanks, DG.
Thank you.
Thanks to all y'all. And thanks to you for listening. This is DG Martin, Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.